This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. The coast of North Carolina is known as the graveyard of the Atlantic, where hundreds of ships have run aground or sunk to the depths of the sea. Can you imagine also that old train cars, aircraft, demolished bridges, and construction waste lay on the ocean floor? These man-made structures make up a collection of underwater artificial reefs that serve as important habitat for fish and invertebrates. Divers are drawn to these sites where colorful sponges and coral grow on the repurposed material. Anglers frequent these fish oases because of the variety and abundance of sea life they attract. Now, anyone with a curiosity about North Carolina's artificial reefs can virtually explore them thanks to an online interactive reef guide recently unveiled by the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries. Artificial reef biologist Amy Comer says people can learn more about the types of fish and materials at each of the state's 42 ocean artificial reefs and 20 estuarine reef sites.
You can zoom in on any of the reef sites in the entire state, look at the side scan sonar information, which is really cool because you can actually see how the material that we've put down on those reef sites sits on the sites. You can click on different material layers and get information about when we put down the material, how much material, stuff like the ships. A lot of them you can click directly on those ships, and you can find out a little bit of history on them.
Comer says the new website had over 1,800 hits in the first week. The Division of Marine Fisheries is also providing a 131-page full-color reef guide printed on waterproof paper. They're available for free at their headquarters in Morehead City or at any of their division offices in eastern North Carolina. Maintaining and creating artificial reef sites is economically, ecologically, and scientifically invaluable.
Artificial reefs are intentionally deployed on the seafloor so that they can mimic natural reefs.
Marine ecologist Avery Paxton says artificial reefs host a biologically diverse ecosystem essential to many organisms for spawning, breeding, and feeding.
And there still remain unanswered questions about if the artificial are successfully mimicking the natural reefs, and that's one of the things that our research group is trying to answer.
Paxton is involved in a two-year project focused on understanding how to use artificial reefs to enhance fisheries. She's also a PhD candidate at the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City. Natural reefs are formed from exposed rock and are found in near shore and at mid and outer shelf areas. They come in a variety of shapes and sizes.
Some of them are extraordinarily flat, like a parking lot. Other ones have nooks and crannies, or a little bit rubble-like. And then we also have some that are very, very complex habitats that rise up into expansive ledges. They have overhangs and underhangs.
Natural and artificial reefs may differ in appearance, but their purpose is the same.
These reefs are federally designated as what's called essential fish habitat because they are so important. And the reason these reefs are important for the fish is because the fish use them to eat there. They use the reefs to hide from predators. They use them as nursery grounds, and they even use them as stepping stones. And what I mean by this is that as fish move from nearshore shallow waters when they're younger to offshore deeper waters when they're older, they use them as stepping stones to move along this corridor.
As part of her research, Paxton is trying to determine the optimal distance between natural and artificial reefs to maximize fish production. There's currently a 200-foot buffer zone because the current line of thinking is that an artificial reef may upset the balance of a natural reef if it's too close. Paxton says this hasn't been scientifically substantiated, and she hopes to have an answer soon.
What we have found, though, is that the reef-associated fish really rely on the structure itself of these objects on the seafloor. And we see a sharp drop-off in the number of fish as you move from the structure into the sediment that surrounds it. And usually this drop-off starts to occur around 30 meters, so around 90 feet from the structure.
Paxton observed that the types of fish found on reefs are very different than those found in the sand between. This, she believes, is due to their preference in food.
Maybe the vegetarian fish are in one area, maybe the carnivorous fish are in another area is one way we like to think of it. So their location reflects the food resources. Different food resources occur in the sediment or sand than on the structure.
Another aspect of her research measures the effectiveness of different types of artificial reef structures. She studied how well concrete pipes, reef balls, pods, train cars, and other material were at growing and producing fish.
The ships that are intentionally sunk seem to support much higher numbers of fish than both the naturally occurring reefs and other types of artificial structures made out of concrete. And this really surprised us, but one of our hypotheses for why this might be happening is that the ships provide a really large structure that oftentimes protrudes well up into the water column above the seafloor and may be able to offer a different type of habitat resource for these fish.
Paxton adds that artificial concrete structures appear to support equivalent fish to the naturally occurring rocky reefs they're intended to mimic. Although there is no official name for this research project, it's funded by the North Carolina Coastal Recreational Fishing License Grant Program and will continue through 2017. Paxton says the findings could very well change the way artificial reefs are constructed and maintained off our coast, and potentially may influence artificial reef construction worldwide. East Carolina University is an anomaly among most North Carolina universities. While much of the state looks forward to winter, to the start of basketball season, Pirate fans long for autumn and the start of football season. ECU football is in its 85th year, and 2016 may go down as one of the more notable campaigns in program history. It's Coach Scotty Montgomery's first year, and it follows the controversial sacking of his predecessor, Ruffin McNeil. Chris Thomas spoke to Jeff Charles, longtime radio play-by-play commentator for ECU football, about where the Pirates stand now and what their prospects are for the rest of the season.
This team has started at 2-1. Is this a good 2-1 this team has gotten off to, or is this maybe a shakier or maybe even a problematic 2-1?
No, anytime you look at East Carolina's schedules and you look down through the history of the program in September, East Carolina, almost every year in recent years, has played ACC schools, SEC schools. You might mix in some other big-time programs as well. And so the September schedule for East Carolina is always very, very difficult. And for East Carolina at this point to be 2-1 with a chance to go 3-1, that says a lot for where the football program is, because most of these games in September, East Carolina is an underdog in these games, and they have to pull upsets to win.
We're already a quarter of the way through the season, three games in, and do you see a team identity already shaping?
Yeah, I think so. I think Scotty Montgomery has brought a very disciplined approach, a very businesslike, workmanlike approach, and I think you see that on the field. I think the kids are very confident because he's very confident. He's a bright young guy. He's only 38 years old. I think he has a terrific future in football coaching. And I think that confidence that he radiates really is passed along to his players. And I think the kids have really bought in here. And it was a difficult transition going from Ruffin McNeil to Scotty Montgomery. Coach Ruff is very popular here. He was a Pirate. He played at East Carolina, graduated from the school. It was not a very popular decision when he was let go last year. But those things happen in college athletics and college football. It's a big business these days. And Scotty Montgomery's had a big job coming in here and kind of settling the waters, as he likes to say, with the fan base, and he's done a good job with that. And I think the players have really picked up and bought into what he wants to do, and I think this team looks really good.
You mentioned discipline, and that's something that stood out to me is the penalty situation. It was a real killer last year and in some of the more recent seasons. But this year, as far as where we are in the season, three games in, this is the lowest penalty total and penalty yards since 2012. And you know, is that something that stood out to you as well?
Yeah, there's no question about that. Especially the first two games, it was really good. I mean, the penalties were way down the first two. Now, last week, they took a step back because there were eight penalties in the game. And as I went down into the locker room to visit with Coach Montgomery for a television show, he was really upset, to be honest with you, when I walked in the locker room, and those eight penalties drove him crazy because he has emphasized so much, we're not going to have penalties this year. And, you know, things happen in the heat of the battle of the game, and you preach it and you preach it, but, you know, guys are 18, 19, 20 years old, and things happen in games, and sometimes they get penalties.
It looks like, you know, the AAC may not be a power conference, but they're certainly not cupcakes this year. Is this going to be a tough conference for the Pirates to sail their way through?
Well, the good news is East Carolina doesn't have to play Houston this year, and Houston's the number 6 team in America. But they've got a tough schedule, and October's a very big month for ECU. Now, they open up with UCF, and that's a team that did not win a game last year. They had a nightmarish season. They were 0-12, but they are much improved. They took a Big Ten team, Maryland, into double overtime in Orlando last week before they lost that game. So they are a lot better. And then East Carolina has to go down to South Florida and play USF. And USF is picked to win the East Division of the American Athletic Conference. It's going to be a tough game down there. South Florida is 3-0. Also, Navy comes in. Navy has been a nightmare for the Pirates to play against with that offense that they run. The Pirates have had a devil of a time with that over the years. That's going to be another tough game, and the Pirates have to go to Cincinnati, play a really good Cincinnati team. They got a vote this week in the top 25, and they're really good, and they expect to have a good season as well.
What do you think the outcome is going to be on a Saturday afternoon?
Well, I never predict games, but I will tell you this. I think the Pirates will go up there and play very well. East Carolina has a history of playing very well against Virginia Tech. The Pirates have won the last two games over the Hokies, so they really have the confidence that they can go up there and win the football game. Being around the players, and I go to practice on Tuesday nights and talk with the players, they're very confident they can go up there and win the game. So, like I say, I never predict games. I never put little W's and L's beside games, but I will say that East Carolina will go up there and play well, compete, they'll play their rear ends off, and they'll have a chance, I think, to win the game and play hard. They'll be very well prepared with Coach Montgomery, and I think they'll have an opportunity to win the football game on the road in a tough environment coming up on Saturday.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
African-American musicians influenced the world of pop, jazz, and blues in the past, and their influence continues today. Many are surprised to learn that a number of African-American musicians came from right here in eastern North Carolina. Portraits of these legendary artists are on display at the Emerge Gallery and Arts Center in Greenville. Mac McKee spoke with Holly Garriott, the director of the Pitt County Arts Council, about the exhibition.
This exhibit features around 66 framed photos from renowned photographers like Cedric Chatterley and Titus Brooks Higgins.
Yes, so we're very excited to have this exhibition. This is actually a traveling show that the North Carolina Arts Council has put together, and they have brought together two photographers. Cedric Chatterley's style is portraiture, and so what he has done is taken the portraits of really well-known and renowned musicians from eastern North Carolina. And then Titus Brooks Higgins takes a different approach. His work is about capturing the moment, performing, and so it's got a real energy to them. So their styles are very different, but it's really amazing to see how they complement one another.
What are some of your favorite parts of the exhibit, if you had to choose?
Really special quality that I love is one musician that I can think of that it's really amazing to see is Dick Knight. And so you see the current portrait of Dick, you see him in performance, and then you see a picture from the 50s or 60s.
Now, you mentioned Dick Knight as one of the Eastern North Carolina artists featured in the exhibit. What part of the eastern part of the state was he from, and what are some of the other Eastern North Carolina artists featured in this exhibit?
So there's 8 counties that are represented, and Dick is from Kinston. He's actually part of a 2-man group right now with Bill Myers. And Bill is originally from Greenville and now lives in Wilson. Bill is actually the reason why we have an African American music trail and why we have this exhibit. He really helped bring this idea together.
And two of the most popular, jazz pianist Thelonious Monk, and on the pop side, Little Eva, who did The Locomotion, written by Carole King and her husband at the time, Jerry Goffin.
Absolutely. And it is just so exciting to know that these individuals came from eastern North Carolina. And then we also have Roberta Flack has ties. Maceo and Melvin Parker from Kinston were part of the James Brown Band.
Are the portraits on random display themselves, or are they basically in specific categories that the viewer can go from one category to the next?
So the way we've decided to display it here at Emerge Gallery is we actually have two separate gallery spaces. We have the portraits running throughout intermittently between the historic photographs, which are in our Edwards Gallery, and then in our separate Wooten Gallery, we have the performance-based images.
So how long will this exhibit be on display?
So this exhibit will be on display at Emerge Gallery through September 30th. We also have documentation of this exhibit online, both at pittcountyarts.org, but also at africanamericanmusicnc.com. There's an incredible website documenting the African American Music Trail, which includes music, but also cuisine, the African American experience in cuisine, and other places to visit within these eight counties.
All right, Holly, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
The Pitt County Arts Council is presenting the African American Music Series, the second Tuesday of each month through May 2017. The next free performance features Melvin Parker and Marcus Parker on October 14th at the Emerge Gallery and Arts Center. For more information, go to the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org.
It's Cosmic Saxophones on American Roots with New Orleans jazz to roots rock. Saxophonist Charles Neville and free jazz savant Charles Lloyd describe their musical journeys. Also archival chin music with sax legends Sonny Rollins, Yusef Lateef, and Sam Butera. I'm Nick Spitzer with Cosmic Saxophones on American Roots from PRX.
Saturday evening at 6 o'clock on all of the PRE Public Radio E stations.
My name is Carrie Irish, and my family and I have lived in Beaufort for the last 8 years. In living in Carteret County, my husband works for Duke, I work for UNC, but we're not a house divided when it comes to supporting Public Radio East. As long as we're not talking basketball, we're okay. For us, supporting public radio is important. I get myself engaged in a story, and I love big picture science, big fan of living on Earth. I find the BBC News a refreshing source. I think it's important as Americans to listen to other countries and other people and learn from them and have a better appreciation for what's going on in the world. See, for me, it's all about ethics. I think we have a moral responsibility to look out after this world and make the world a better place, and I think public radio is a big part of that. The only way public radio is going to be available is if we support it. I'm Carrie Irish, and I am Public Radio East.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. We have a special guest today, Tony O'Neill, the founder of Possumwood Acres Wildlife Sanctuary. Tony is a state and federally licensed wildlife rehabilitator. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Today we're going to talk about armadillos. They look a little bit like a possum, but then they have that armored shell. What are they really?
They are a mammal, so they will nurse their babies. And you're right, they look like a possum with armor. They're related to things like the anteaters. And so they're going to have very similar lifestyles, habitats, and diets.
When I hear armadillos, I think Texas or maybe Georgia. Where do armadillos currently live, and could they really be headed our way?
They like the warm weather because cold is their enemy. Cold can kill them off if we have long extended cold periods. And they are moving their territories up. They're coming up from Florida, and they're up from Georgia, and they're in South Carolina, and we've got reports of them in Wilmington and heading toward Onslow County.
Interesting. Some people have a rather negative view of armadillos. Why do you think that is?
Well, they can cause some destruction with your yards and your gardens. And I think that's the thing that frustrates people the most. They put a lot of time into a garden, as you know, and then to have come out in the morning and find out something went through during the night and went looking for grubs and termites and ants and worms and kind of dug up the garden. And that can be very, very frustrating.
So I think you've already alluded to this, but what sort of things do armadillos eat?
They love insects. So in a way, they are kind of helpful if you've got bad lawn grubs. They're going to be digging those out, getting rid of those. They do like fire ants. So anything that likes a fire ant is a friend in my book. They like the termites. So if you've got some rotten wood around, they may alert you to that as a problem, that that may be something you need to be taking care of.
And so most of the damage that we would see would be the digging that they do as they're looking for this food, as opposed to them actually, say, eating your plant.
Yeah, they're not, and they may be digging for the grubs that may be down around the bottom or the roots of the plant. They're really not trying to hurt the plant per se. They're just looking for the bugs that are down in the garden. And if you've got a nicely aerated garden, there's probably nice worms down in there, the earthworms, that they're looking for those as well. So that's the digging is causing the damage, but they're not trying to be destructive to your property.
Are there any other things that people should be concerned about when they think about armadillos? Do we need to be concerned about diseases or anything like that?
Actually, yes. Not rabies, because that's not something that they're prone to. However, they are prone to what's known as Hansen's disease that we know as leprosy. It is something that they can carry this bacteria in their system, and it would just be just like if you ever saw any diseased wildlife, you would want to stay away. So they tell people to not handle it with bare hands if they catch one or they're trying to trap and relocate one. I think you would be safe dealing with one. I wouldn't be overly worried about it, but it is something just to kind of keep in the back of your mind if you saw one with maybe a lot of sores on it or something. And then you would know that it's sick, obviously, and you would wanting to call animal control and get that one removed from the area.
Right. So like any other wildlife, if it looked like it wasn't behaving normally or
correct, whether it's a raccoon with rabies or a fox with distemper, sure, you want to just get sick animals out of the environment.
If armadillos were to make it further up into the coastal plain, what would be the way that we would be able to perhaps control them on our property? What would be the steps to take?
There's actually a couple of different things that you can do. One would be trying to maybe sink wire down around an area you don't want them digging into. But you would have to sink it pretty far because they can dig deeply and rapidly. People have thought about putting up fencing. However, they can climb. So some of the what they call the cat-proof fencing where they kind of sag a little, they would be something that you could use. But the best thing that I have found looking at the different type of deterrents for these are things that are going to interfere with their sense of smell. They don't really use their vision. It's more their noses to smell out the insects. So if you put things that are stinky down there, they're not going to like it. Mothballs, ammonia-soaked cotton balls out would be something that would keep them away.
Is there anybody that's monitoring the spread of armadillos? If somebody found armadillos in a county that they have not already been identified in, is there somebody we should contact or let them know?
Yes, that would be our Wildlife Resources Commission that regulates all wildlife in North Carolina. And you can go onto their website at www.ncwildlife.org. And then you would be able to find out how to contact them and report that you actually have seen them and you can document that they are in your neighborhood.
Excellent. Tony, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. I hope people appreciate the armadillo because I love the little guys. I would love to have some up here at our wildlife sanctuary.
I love it. You can learn more about Tony and her wildlife rehabilitation efforts at possumwoodacres.org.
One of North Carolina's most beloved treasures, the wild horse herds of the Outer Banks, is the subject of an exhibition at the Carolina Artist Gallery, now through November 11th.
My name is Sheila Brodnick, and I'm the treasurer of Carolina Artist Gallery. It's an art show, and it's celebrating the history and the free spirit of wild horses. We have a lot of photographers who like to photograph wildlife, and we came up with the idea for a show. We opened it to all media. We have paintings, prints, photos, a few sculptural pieces. It's open until Friday, November the 11th, and it's at our gallery, which is located on Evans Street at the corner of 8th in downtown Moorhead, right about a block away from the Marlin Fountain. And our gallery is open from Tuesday through Saturday from 11 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. And all of the artwork is for sale. Part of the proceeds will benefit the Foundation for Shackleford Horses. For more information on this event, go to publicradioeast.org, events calendar.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at our website, publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.